Guys, welcome to another episode of Ben Clymer Presents. We are presenting the New York December 2023 auction season. We are coming off some pretty weird results, if you can even call them that, results at all, in Hong Kong from our friends at Phillips and Christie's and other. We had the Oak sale, which was tumultuous, I would say. Some of the top lots not selling at all, then others doing okay. We had a traditional Christie's sale, which did a little bit better, and then we had a Phillips sale, which did okay as well. But now we're in New York. The world is a weird place right now. We spent this morning and this afternoon looking at Sotheby's and Phillips. What do we think, Tony?
Ben, thanks for having me on the show again. I think to start it off, I think there's sort of a lot of cautiousness in the market. I think just talking to the specialists, there's some good watches there that seem to have a lot of interest at both sales. But beyond that, a lot of sort of cautious talk about how much interest there is in the sales. That said, we saw a lot of good watches. I think we really focused on seeing vintage watches today, guys,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which was cool. We saw some vintage stuff too, or some modern stuff too, I should say. Some RMs I was excited to see that we'll get into, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But a lot of cautious talk, I think, in the sales rooms today.
Yeah.
I kind of wonder if, it was maybe a good thing for Phillips to get their one pass lot out of the way in Geneva.
The solitary pass lot.
Yeah.
The single red sea dweller.
Yeah. And it was, I don't know how many years since they've had a pass lot. And I think at some point it was bound to happen.
Right. And I happen to know that watch did sell after the auction.
It was bound to happen. I know that they'll obviously want to sell every single lot, but there was a part of me that thought, like, well, if you know you're not going to get it in the room, don't push it too hard. Don't mm-hmm. try to find somebody because you're going to have it happen at some point. The market seems to be heading that direction anyway, and mm-hmm. it's sort of an albatross around your neck at some point to feel like you have to sell every single lot for Phillips. Mm-hmm. Now we can kind of get back into like, okay, what is a real auction going
to
be like?
Yeah, and I think that's kind of what both of you guys are insinuating here. Like, it's almost a return to pre-COVID pandemonium, right? Like, this is what auctions used to be like, which is like, okay, like, there's some amazing top lots that, you know, the usual suspects or maybe some X factors will come in and you know, throw down on, but you don't really know what's going to happen until you get to the day of the sale. And that's exciting, I think, for a lot of us that are kind of casual or professional observers to all this stuff.
Go ahead.
Oh, I think the one disappointment for me, looking sort of across everything, and I'm excited about the sales, but I think when the auction houses are feeling what we're feeling, they're trying to maximize every single lot and the amount of time that they put in. And so I know for a fact that one auction house in particular decided nothing below $5,000 estimate. Don't spend our time, put that in online sales. Because there's only so much, time. We're not going back to the days of 400 lots in an auction generally.
Right. Which was a drag, to be clear. I don't want that.
I don't want that either. I do want some of those like sneaky picks that you can pick up, but yeah. But I think, you know, we're gonna sort of reach a middle ground on the two.
Yeah, I agree, and then we'll get into what we saw today. I think that there's this really challenging middle ground of like offering things that enthusiasts really like you guys, myself, our readers and listeners, and then also being able to, you know, have things make economic sense for an auction. I remember somebody publicly suggested that Aurel host a Jaeger LeCoultre reverso auction, like a thematic reverso auction. And it was just like that, that would be very challenging to do for obvious reasons. There's not that many interesting reversos out there that would inspire that much. It's not like Daytona or Day-Date or anything like that. So you have one side of like offering things that aren't available elsewhere in these special auctions because it's a special format, and then having it make financial sense. So like, I'm surprised that, frankly, people didn't come to that conclusion earlier, that you kind of needed a certain floor of value to go into auctions. But enough about that. Tony, take us down the list here.
To me, the reverso is the forgotten icon, but we'll leave that for another day.
It's a total icon. Lenny Kravitz says so. You know, it's 100% an icon. I own one, as you know. It's a great watch.
So we went to Sotheby's first today. We saw a bunch of watches there. I think we're going to take it by brand a little bit, guys. So let's start with Patek. I think we focused on vintage Pateks. We saw 1518 there. We saw 1463 there. Mm-hmm. Some 2526s. Mm-hmm. Ben, why don't you kick it off for us and what stuck out to you from Sotheby's Pateks?
Yeah, I mean, the 1518 pink, I'm going to defer to you guys on legitimately because I think you actually might know more about that market right now than I do. The highlight for me was the 1463 Breguet Tiffany, right? So that watch is everything a vintage watch should be. It's not perfect, which I think a vintage watch should not be, because I think, like, what's the point of being an old thing if it hasn't lived a life? It is polished. The dial has, like, a real warmth to it and, you know, what you could call patina or dirt or whatever you want to call it. But the fact that it's a yellow gold watch, which to me is, like, quintessential vintage watch, plus Tiffany, plus Breguet, is really very neat. And, you know, this is not one of those, like, hey, fresh to market, like, from the original family sitting there for 50 years in a drawer. It was sold quite publicly by Davide Parmigiani, who's a great and well-known dealer. It was in one of his catalogs. So it doesn't have that kind of, like, fresh to market charm, but it's still just an incredible watch. And I've never seen another Tiffany 1463 like this anywhere. I've seen kind of the later series ones, a little bit like my 1968 Cartier signed 1463, which have smaller signatures, really bright white dials. The stamping is in a different position, usually down below. This is a proper vintage watch. And I think, you know, the folks at Sotheby's say, like, you know, that people are holding their cards pretty tight to the chest, but this is a very compelling watch. It just comes down to the number on this watch. I mean, this is a watch that I would love to own. It just would depend on the number. And I think gold, yellow gold, you know, worn vintage Patek is, it's starting to pick up a little bit again, but it has not been the hottest thing in the world over the past 5 years. We could say that.
You mentioned number. Do you want to talk numbers? I mean, it's got an estimate of $200,000 to $400,000.
Yeah.
Do you have any feel for what it's compelling at, for maybe even you personally? I don't know.
I mean, look, if I were in the market, for me, it's under compelling. Now, I'm not saying it's actually going to sell for this. Under three for sure. Will it sell for that? Probably not. You know, I think it's special enough where it could go much higher. I think if the case were a little bit thicker, it could do serious numbers, I think. But, you know, I'm not one of those guys that's super, you know, militant about unpolished cases. Like, watches have lives, just like we all do. I'm okay with a little bit of a polish on a watch. I just think, like, you know, this is a really special thing. So to get a big number for a yellow gold 1463, you're going to need something pretty special in the case department. We'll talk about another 1463 at Phillips later, which, you know, I would say is a little bit stronger in the case arena, but has other things going for sure. But the 1463J Tiffany Breguet, that is a very me watch. It's a very compelling watch for sure.
It's not one that I would have necessarily, if I was in the market, jumped at from photos, and then I handled it. I said that to you in person. Like, yeah. I handled it a little bit more, and the white dials that pop out a little bit more, they're a little more compelling on paper. But it's also the fact that it's been worn. If I had a collection of watches in a similar price point, I would actually feel comfortable wearing this out, wearing it around, meeting people, having something that's a little special, not feeling too precious about it versus other things. Because that, I think that is a concern, is, you know, you, if it's been worn, it doesn't have to sit in the safe.
Right, you can continue to wear it.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, the 1463 Cartier that I had, like, that was a similar condition in many ways, in that, like, it was worn quite famously, and you could wear it, and, like, it felt good wearing it, and you didn't have to baby it. And this 1463 is very much that. There are other watches around that are, you know, could sell for a lot more that you really, I would be uncomfortable wearing, because, like, oh, shit, I just put the first scratch in this perfectly mint lug, you know.
Or even the dial, like, if the dial starts to pick up some sort of patina that you didn't see before, or you're worried about it and you're always looking at it like, oh, is that dial, did I do something, was it too humid out there when I walked out the door one day or something? So I think that was a really compelling watch for me, and I mean, like, who doesn't love Breguet?
Sure.
Period. Tiffany is always interesting. We had a conversation about this at Sotheby's, is where Tiffany was stamping on that day and what guy was doing the stamping and stuff like that. It does lend some sort of interest, because it's always going to be a little different.
Yeah.
And that can be scary to some buyers, but that's another reason, not saying that auction houses have been infallible, but that's another reason I do like seeing watches that have gone through a lot of hands.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, like, where they stamp Tiffany, like, I have never researched this, so don't quote me on this, but, like, in my mind, now that I think about it, like, the stamp up top is earlier, generally speaking, than stamps down below. So there was a publicly available 1463 later, like 1968, 60, 67, 68, with the stamp down below. My Cartier stamp was down below. If you look at, like, a 25, 26 Tiffany, which are 50s watches, the stamp is up high. And so this watch had the stamp up high, which to me, as you rightly point out, is definitely a neat thing.
Well, there was that compelling Tiffany 25, 26 that I think just sold at Phillips in Hong Kong for a good amount of money, I want to say, which is my transition into asking you, Mark, now that we've exhausted the 1463 conversation, if there's any other vintage Pateks you saw at Sotheby's that really took you.
Well, I mean, we discussed quite a bit the 1518 that was there, and that one definitely stood out. I've seen a weird number of them for a short amount of time that I've been in the watch industry. It is a really still rare and special watch, but the one
it's the watch, right?
It's the watch. Yeah. Even to me, I would say I would probably lean more to 1518 over a 2499, despite size and all these other factors, just because it is the originating watch. But it surprises me how many I've seen for how few there are. And that one I think did stand out, but it does start to blend together a little bit. I don't know if when you see them back to back, that helps.
Which we did today, which
helps. But then you try to think back over the last year of maybe seeing a half dozen or more, what stands out. This one I definitely think was a good one, despite not necessarily being like the strangest dial or anything like that.
Yeah, I know for a fact, after talking to Sotheby's specialists, some of the fact that so many 1518s have come up over the past few years originates from the fact that in 2021 in New York, they had that pink on pink 1518 that sold for about $10 million, like one of the most expensive vintage watches ever sold.
Ever. Right.
And it was an absolutely mint, you know, probably the best pink on pink 1518 on the planet.
Yeah.
I know for a fact some watches have come to Sotheby's specifically since that consignment.
Including this one, I believe.
I think that might be true. I can't know. I don't know about this one specifically. I know about the last pink on pink they sold in New York back in June. That's the case. That watch that sold for $10 million is probably the best watch I've ever seen in person, the best vintage watch I've ever seen in person. So nothing really compares to that, but it also sat in a drawer for 70 years. So it's tough to compare. This one's not perfect, but as you were talking about with the 1463, it comes from the original owner. It's got a nice condition report, honestly, documenting. It's been polished. The dial's not perfect, but it looks good. It's a good, honest watch from, I think it's the Kaplan family, from the original owner. There's literally even a photo or a portrait that they painted of the guy wearing the watch in the 60s or the 70s. So you kind of know the entire history of the watch, the story of it coming to market. And yep. For me, that's something you see less and less with vintage Patek in general. Just knowing the entire sort of provenance, and this one hasn't traded hands and dealers haven't gotten their hands on it yet, which is something that remains sort of exciting to me.
Well, and it adds to sort of the legacy of these things too. I mean, we were talking about earlier today, the fact that like a number of years ago, we thought that there were maybe eight pink 1518s, and now there's 15 is sort of the number. And
right.
And they come out. Now, I do feel maybe a little bit for the family because any family that would discover this, only so much that I could feel badly for somebody that all of a sudden discovers a $1 million watch.
Sure.
But you know, you're not going to get the $10 million. No. And I often wonder how much they really understand that, like how much they're hoping or whatever it is. But I mean, it's nice to have one more scholarship. I don't know. I've not seen all of them, so I can't rank them.
Yeah.
But it does help you understand what these things look like, what variations they've come in, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I think the delta between like a 9.5 and a 10 in terms of 1518s, like the price is going to be significant. You know, the best in the world, whichever, in this case, I think most would agree that Tony is right here. The one that they sold previously is probably the best in the world. You're going to get many X the price at that level, because you're talking about, frankly, the wealthiest, most educated watch consumers on the planet going for this stuff. It's not your average guy. It's not you, me, or you. You know, going for this stuff. And so, to have the very best 1518, which, you know, John Goldberger famously has said is kind of like it is his favorite watch, and so many others as well, you're going to sell for many X. But I think it's so fascinating because, like, that watch, which, as you said, comes from the original family, like, that is an incredible thing, and yet we saw two of them today.
Speaking on condition, that brings us to the vintage Rolex portion of today's Sotheby's discussion. I wanted to start us by talking about the John Player Special that we saw. It's a 6241. Ben, what did you think of that watch?
Killer. That is fresh to the market, original family, just fucking dead mint. And it should go crazy. I mean, it's one of the nicest I've seen in a long time. And this one deserves to go at auction. And just let the market kind of price it as it sees fit, you know?
I love that you said that you love gold Daytonas as opposed to most people that don't. I mean, I'm sure they are out there, but like, that's the thing that I think was said a little bit when we were looking at this watch. It's like, I hate to admit it, I'm that guy.
No, 100%. I would kill to be that guy.
It's such a good watch. To me, pops a lot more than like the Lemon Paul Newman's do. Condition was fantastic. I think it's interesting because you look closely at these watches and you see even if the condition is fantastic, the little ways that these watches differ from each other, even not necessarily polishing or whatever, just like these were to some extent not necessarily mass produced in the same way that we mass produce watches now. And so everything has its own little thing, but this is a great watch.
Yeah, and we've seen a few, kind of like the Pink 1518s. Like we've seen a few JPSs come out over the past few years, including even at Sotheby's. This is right up there, in my opinion.
Well, so one of the last ones we saw was Sotheby's back in May. They sold one, and it went for about $2 million. Mm. Mark and I both were in the room, actually. So we saw Rolex won that watch, and it sold for $2 million. So I don't think we're going to expect that same price. But yeah, they've got a $400,000 to $600,000 estimate
on this one. That, right?
I think it's a seven-figure watch, right?
If it's not, I think something the market has changed a lot. If it's not, you know, so yes, I do think it's a low seven figure watch.
And I think the other thing about these is like this is a watch that you don't necessarily know who the people are in the room for a Rolex the same way that you do for, you know, a Patek or specifically like an AP or Vacheron that might be a high ticket thing.
Yeah,
you could have some guy roll in, you know, some kid in his 30s or 20s and a Ferrari and decide that he's going to drop $2 million on this because he at least knows enough to know that this is a killer watch and one that's going to stand out. The other fun thing about this is it's not a knock on this that it didn't come on the original bracelet, which I think is pretty cool. Like the condition is fantastic, partially
with no bracelet marks on the back of the lugs.
Yep.
Which is a selling point in many ways, you know? Yeah. I mean, you can get a bracelet wherever easily, but to have it like really, really unpolished is pretty neat.
I want to transition us to a slightly different portion of Rolex and vintage dive watch and vintage military watch collecting. About 60 of the watches in Sotheby's sale are coming from Alan Hammer Bloor, who is kind of this legendary collector. He's been collecting watches since the 80s. He's been involved in the Panerai community. So there's a lot of vintage Panerai, vintage Rolex, modern Panerai in this collection from Hammer. He's in New York this week to sort of say goodbye to the watches and the collecting community that's been so kind to him over the years. It's really sort of a cool story to see and hear and read about. Ben, is there anything you want to add to Hammer's story?
Yeah, Alan is not a guy I know super well, but a guy I know of extremely well. I mean, he's been around long before I was around. You know, really a great bastion of optimism within the watch collecting community and just beloved by all. I mean, I've known him through friends at Panerai and through Jeff Hess, who's now at Sotheby's, you know, for years and years. And really just like salt of the earth, great guy. And in many ways, it's exciting and a little sad, of course, to see the watches go. But I think the expertise and scholarship that he's applied to his own collecting is considerable, for sure. And there's some killer watches in there.
Some really cool watches. I mean, from an emotional standpoint, I can't help but root for all of them to absolutely crush every estimate, regardless of, like, is it representative of the market, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. You know, he's talked about this money will go and to benefit his family. It's not for charity, but like his family will need the support after he's gone. And and I think, you know, for me, I'm rooting for every one of those. I'm not necessarily a big Panerai fan or lover of Panerai or even knowledgeable about Panerai. And, you know, I talked to Jeff Hess about that because he is the Panerai guy. And apparently some really interesting watches in there. I wish I knew more just because I think it would actually inform my understanding of who this guy is and why he's interested in what he is, which is for me, like, yeah, we all like the watches, but I really love hearing about why people love the things they love or why they do what they do. And so it was interesting to see that, and also just kind of somber at the same time.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this, just to speak of the watches, like the standout for me, there's a lot of great Rolex. I know we're going to touch on that, but the standout for me was the PAM 21, which is a watch that I won't name names. Rich Forden looked at it and was like, oh, stupid Panerai. And I was like, no, bro, like this is a special thing. And I pulled it out for me to look at. Because, you know, like a lot of Panerais look the same. They all, in fact, look the same, or many of them do. And this is a watch I have lusted after for years. And the PAM 21 came out in the late 90s. It's a platinum case. They made 60 of them. This watch is particularly difficult to find with a full set. It had two case backs and, you know, special boxes and blah, blah, blah. This Hammer's watch, of course, has that plus, plus, plus. That is a very compelling watch. If you're into Panerai or if you're not, it's quintessential Panerai, and it's early. You know, it's late 90s, so we're talking, you know, approaching 30 years ago. That's a really, really cool watch from the Hammer collection.
My pick was the Australian Navy Big Crown 5510.
Yeah.
I think when I asked Jeff Hess, who you had on a few episodes ago, you know, if he's getting excited about a vintage sub like that, you know, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
I think it's cool for the watch, but it also comes with all these Australian Navy sort of miscellaneous things. There's a cigarette case. There's like nose pins or nose clips or something like that. Field notebooks, all this crazy stuff that you just don't really find in a quote unquote watch set. So really cool to see all of that stuff that comes with the lot.
Yeah, I thought that was great. I mean, I don't want to skip ahead too much, but that sort of extra ephemera thing sort of makes me think of the one watch that I'm curious to see what is going to happen. I don't know that I can prognosticate on it, but if I can skip ahead to the Weems watch, the Admiral Byrd Weems mm-hmm. watch, that's got Admiral Byrd's flight logs. It's got all of these sort of associated things. And I've heard from some people that there's been a lot of interest from non-watch people, museums, those kinds of things, trying to suss out, I mean, what a watch that has no direct comps for a Longines, yeah. Weems, you know, flight watch might bring. I'm curious because I like the wild cards. I mean, you could yeah. show up and somebody could say, oh, this is a $10,000 watch or it's $1 million watch.
Right, and I think that makes me think of probably 7-8 years ago, there was this trend of like, celebrity or provenance driven watches doing better outside of watch auctions. They're like Steve McQueen's Monaco sold for like $795,000 at a like Hollywood memorabilia sale or something like that. Meanwhile, if you know the watch that sold at Antiquorum sold for like $250. So we're talking 3x. And the dream for every watch auctioneer is to find that thing that crosses into pop culture or just political culture, whatever, Paul Newman, have you. And you know, this watch could do that. I mean, it may or may not. Like, it's not Paul Newman, it's not Steve McQueen, but it's still a compelling thing that will appeal to different types of people.
I would think a lot of aviation people have probably dumped a lot of money in their planes and maybe wouldn't have the estimate range of 100,000 to 200,000 to buy a aeronautical sort of hero's watch, but sure. I don't know, it could do that potentially. I have no idea. My one favorite thing, and we didn't get to see the movement, but apparently the movement is stamped extra, and even Longines doesn't exactly know what that meant in the case of that movement. There's no like documentation of that, and I like little stories like that. I mean, we've just lost some of this, and that's why it's important to like document these watches as best as we can, and when we find out something to share it.
Yeah,
because sometimes these things get lost to time if you don't.
Yeah. Let's rattle off a few other watches that we liked at Sotheby's before we move on.
I wanted to ask you for one wild card pick in the indie, modern, neo vintage, whatever else we haven't covered from Sotheby's.
RM35.
That was mine too.
That was yours too. Yeah. I mean, I've said this many times, but like the RM35 to me is not the Nadal. It is the RM I've kind of like secretly lusted after, not so secretly. The RM27 is actually the one that I want, but that's $1 million plus. This is the baby Nadal. You don't see him that often at auction. You see him on Chrono 24. You see him through gray market guys, whatever. But to just an RM35 is like that. That is a very neat RM. That is quintessential RM. And they had one at Sotheby's.
Beater RM, right?
It's a beater RM.
Yeah. I've never seen one in person. I've listened to nerds like you talk about it on Hodinkee Radio and whatever else. And yeah. just the mind. I was going to say mind fuck, but I don't want to.
You can swear here, Tony. It's okay.
The mindfuck of picking that thing up, 5 grams or whatever it is, and putting it on the wrist. I didn't think I would like it as much as I did, but what a cool watch.
That is the secret of RM. Like, you know, the guys like us here with the shawl collars and the glasses and such, like, we're like, RM isn't for us. And then you pick one up, it's like, wow, this is actually really, really cool.
You can't help it. Well, listen, that's a good place to leave the Sotheby's discussion. I want to get us over to Phillips, where we went after that.
Yep.
I think we're going to start just with Vintage Paddock again, sort of circling back. We saw some of the same references, honestly. We saw 1518 Rose there. We saw 1463, some other stuff. Yeah. Ben, anything in particular?
Yeah, I mean, look, we'll just touch briefly on the 1518 Pink because we have to. Like, this is when watches are silly, right? Like, these are both of these watches. Is he either 1518, any 1518 is amazing. To see two in pink gold, basically 30 blocks away from each other on the same day, is just bananas, right? I mean, we said, okay, let's say there's 15, so we saw 1/7 of the world's population of 1518 pinks today.
Yeah, I mean, how do you process this? And I know, like, this can sometimes be a criticism of coverage or whatever, but how do I process something that I have no realm of understanding of spending that amount of money? You know, you have to be very critical and sort of view it in a bubble. I don't know. I don't know if we want to say which one we felt more strongly about.
You can say that.
I mean, I would say if I was buying and I had the funds, I would be going for Sotheby's all day. I don't know even necessarily that Phillips example is a consolation prize or anything like that, but I think that is something that you have to think about, is there are probably people out there that are going to be bidding on one, and if they don't get it,
then they go to
the other one. Beyond what they felt that they would spend, they know that they might have a backup. And I think, I just wonder how that impacts the overall market when you have two together. I don't know if you have thoughts about which one or...
Yeah, it's interesting that the Sotheby's one has an estimate of 800 to 1.5, I believe, whereas the Phillips one is 1.2 to 2.4. And I think we were all taken more by the Sotheby's watch, condition-wise. And as I was speaking about sort of just the originality of the provenance, too, is something that makes it compelling for me as well. The one at Phillips is well-documented as well. It's set in a private collection for the past 20 years when it came to auction in the early 2000s. And I think that sort of sale is well-documented and all of that type of stuff. So two super well-documented reference or examples of the most famous reference there is in vintage watches, but the Sotheby's one I think is more compelling if you're just looking at them in a vacuum.
Yeah. What else do we see in the Patek world at Phillips?
The 3974, I think, is just a crazy watch, right? The minute repeater is just a crazy thing to see.
The 3974 is interesting to me, because those have really starting to have a moment. Tom Brady has one now, apparently, I saw on Instagram, which is neat.
This is the second one I've seen this year, which was surprising to me. There was one in Monaco, and I just like...
A 3974. Yeah, 3974. Those watches were really stone cold for a long time. They would sit at like Michael Safdie's shop up here in Midtown, and just like, who's buying these things, you know? Now they're really hot. This watch is neat because it was worn out with a silver dial. It comes with an additional doré or kind of like shaded dial, slightly less bright dial. What's also neat about this is it's a naked watch, as we call it, so that there's no box, there's no papers for a 3974, which is kind of crazy. Like, where do those go, you know? And in many ways, like if you want a 3974, but you don't want to pay, you know, big money, this could be a great opportunity. And like, there's one side of me that's like, oh, like should I do that? You know, like it's a dream watch that like I'm probably never going to be able to afford, you know, when it's a full set or certainly in any other metals. So this is kind of compelling, but at the same time, also, do you want to put that kind of money into a watch that's naked?
It's surprising to me because I can't imagine a world in where this wasn't, you know, a watch that people were paying attention to. I just wasn't around at that time. I also wasn't, you know, buying watches, or I'm still not buying watches at this level, but like, it does check a lot of the boxes.
It does.
And so, I mean, who knows? Maybe this was, you know, a young Ed Sheeran using the box for rolling papers or whatever and threw it in the trash. You don't know. But like, that doesn't bother me at all if the watch is good and interesting. And I mean, we listened to the chime. I thought it sounded wonderful.
Look, I mean, first, it's part of the 39 series, right? So 3940 and 3970, I know you guys know, but I'll say this. Like, we're really not. They were always well regarded, but they were not well bought and sold. Like, they were just like, okay, like I'll get the 5970, I'll get the whatever, 5140, whatever. So this is the next version of that, the high end version of that. And I just think also it's like the watch, you know, we were talking about this a little bit before. Like, there's so many cool watches that, again, the guys like us want to say, like, oh, like this 4072 Vacheron at this price, like you should absolutely buy that. And then you do buy it. And then, you know, your tastes change, or you need the money for something else, and you try to sell it, and you're like, oh, wait a minute, like, I'm the only guy out here that wants this watch at this price. And I'm not saying that that's the case for a 3974 naked, but there's a lot more people out there. I mean, so on an episode that will come next week, John Reardon said, look, if you're buying a 5970 or a 3970 and it doesn't come with the full set, people don't want it at all, right? And we're talking second case backs and, you know, all that extra jazz. And so I do think on the Patek buyer in particular, unless you have a bounty of watches, you probably do want a full set 3974. If you're, I mean, look, no matter what, it's going to cost you six figures.
I mean, is this like the don't settle on condition kind of situation too? Like, you know, buy the best you can afford, and if you can't afford the best, then don't necessarily buy it.
I'm not saying that. Yeah. To me, it's like again, the market for 3974J. There's not that many people out there buying that watch. Like, there's just not, you know, relative to a Daytona or anything like that. So, you know, if you want to be able to sell it, you want to be able to sell it quickly and without any excuses. And I think a naked watch, there will be some excuses. It will be priced that way for sure. But it would be a challenging one for me, I think.
Two watches on the opposite end of the spectrum for me in terms of price that are like, there might not be a huge market for them, but they're pretty great. The Sector Dial Reference 96, yeah. I thought was great. Again, like, not a huge ticket watch, but made me happy to see it. Indirect center seconds, which I thought was interesting. And I just, you know, I'm happy to see that. I've always been looking for an interesting reference 96. That's cool. Opposite end of the spectrum for things that there's probably not a ton of buyers for, but will maybe, I'm hoping, get a good price, is there was a pocket watch that I was honestly very happy to see everybody go around the table and handle this pocket watch and chime it. 844 Patek perpetual calendar, inline perpetual calendar, or an American perpetual calendar pocket watch.
Yeah, with repeater.
With repeater. And
in white gold.
In white gold. There's two known. The other one is buyer signed in a prominent collection. And this sold in 2016 for 472,000 Swiss francs. I hope that it continues to do that. But again, like, if you're buying that watch, you better darn love it and sit on it, because it's going to be hard to sell. There's a couple people in the world, and and one of them already has one.
And so, thankfully, there's only two of them, so it's not like you're going to have a lot of options. So if you want it, like, now's the time. And this is also ex-Jean-Claude Beaver, right?
Yep. I think, you know, I'm not sure what the bump on provenance like that is like. It's nothing against him. I'm very always very curious on a possibly $500,000 watch how much people are paying a little bit extra because it was in that collection. So I think it's a great watch, and it did make me really happy to see you guys actually enjoying pocket watches, despite how much shit I get for being the pocket watch guy.
I don't know from who. I never give you shit about that. But
guys, as fun as the Patek discussion has been, I'm a bit more of an everyman, so I wanted to talk about a different brand right now. Probably my favorite watch of the day was a Vacheron 4072 chronograph at Phillips. It had a beautiful two-tone dial, sharp gold case, and a matching Geoffroy bracelet. One of my favorite references. No one really cares about it because it's a Vacheron, because it's 34 millimeters, because it's usually in precious metals. But in person, the thing is gorgeous. It wears like a dream. You guys can have your Pateks, your complicated Pateks, your 130s. I'll take the 4072, and it's got a low estimate of $15,000.
Right, like 15 to 30, right?
15 to 30K. I think it'll blow that out of the water. I won it in our mock auction for $40,000, let's say, yesterday. And let me tell you, I still think I got a steal after seeing it in person. It's a gorgeous watch, and it's one of my favorite references.
Yeah, and I think also, so we were kind of toured around the collection by Paul Boutros and others. And Paul's somebody that has written for our site. I've known him for a long time. Yeah. When he gets genuinely excited about a watch, that's a very good sign. And this guy was thrilled over this. He's a Vacheron guy. You know, he said he spent some time kind of chasing this one. Comes from South America, I believe. This is a real deal, authentic, you know, kind of original family, untouched 4072. If it goes anywhere near even the high estimate, I mean, it's a. We've been saying this for years, but we're going to say it again. It's a bargain. Vintage Vacheron remains a bargain.
This is, I mean, let's be honest. I think this is a Phillips estimate and not necessarily a representative estimate, is how I read it. I mean, maybe that's just tinted by the fact that I just handled the watch. And one, you said 34 millimeters. It did not strike me as that in person, which goes to show how much
it wears bigger, right, guys?
Yeah, it wears bigger. I hate saying it, but it's a great watch.
Yeah, the 4072 is like a really flat case, and flat watches tend to wear a little bit bigger. But it's an absolute killer. I'm right there with you on that.
Do you guys want to talk about the Vacheron market any further than that? I think it's sort of an interesting discussion we've had before.
Yeah, challenging. It's really true. I mean, vintage Vacheron, again, I mean, as long as there's been a Hodinkee, I've been saying vintage Vacheron is like a great deal, right? In particular, like the 1950s, 1940s stuff. It goes up, it goes down, it goes left, it goes right, but it remains just a secondary player on the vintage scene. It just does.
Just because it's not Patek?
Yeah, because it's not Patek. That's why, yeah. Again, like look, even vintage Patek, I mean, take the 1518s out of it and look at 1463s, look at 3448s, look at 2526s. Like, these watches, air quotes, should be the thing that everybody wants to work towards. But you kind of skip right over that. Like, if you're a mega collector, you might have some modern Patek or whatever, and then you dip a toe for a 1518 or a 2499 or like a seriously fuck you watch, and you skip right over the 1463s, the 2497s, J's, and sometimes R's. You skip right over that stuff. And I think, you know, if you're skipping over that stuff in the Patek world, you're definitely skipping over the Vacheron stuff.
Which is too bad, because, I mean, I think there's an argument to be made that a lot of these watches are oftentimes rarer in some cases, just because of
power.
Yeah.
In many cases.
So, you know, I've seen it at auction. I've a couple times this year. There were some earlier at specifically the Monaco auction, where just it's like, okay, nobody's going to pay for an ultra thin minute repeater from them. That's a fantastic shape. Sold after under the reserve to somebody in the room. But yeah, it's too bad. But then you see a watch like that chronograph, and it makes you think that maybe you have everything wrong.
Right?
You just have it all wrong. And like, wait, why am I not caring? But as you mentioned, sometimes these things are hard to get out from under if you move on to something else, or you've find something that you've been looking for forever, and you just need to free up some cash. That's not the kind of watch that unfortunately you want to be sitting with.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fool me once, shame on me type of situation. Fool me twice, you know. It's one of those things where it's just like, okay, like I love Vintage Vacheron. I've owned quite a few. But at the end of the day, and I know many people like this, it's just like, all right, even if it is X and you think it's a great deal, try to sell it on the secondary market. You know, and it's just like, if you have a Patek, if you have a Rolex, you might not get exactly what you're asking, but there will be liquidity. There will be the opportunity to sell it. Vintage Vacheron, it's a much different world. It just is. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. In fact, actually, I will say it's wrong, but it just is. And sometimes you just can't fight with what just is.
Yeah, you know what's interesting is I have seen sort of increased interest in their neo-vintage stuff, their ultra-thin QPs from the 90s and stuff like that that's very similar to the vintage AP QPs.
But don't you think that's because those were so cheap that it like, and like you get these guys that are on Instagram and kind of pumping this stuff up because they're so cheap? Like the Vacherons we're talking about here are not that cheap, right? Like that's these are true. Not sub $10,000 watches.
No, it's true. A few years ago, you could have gotten one of these ultra-thin QPs for the same price as, say, a steel vintage Vacheron whatever from the 50s. And I think the QP is a lot easier. It's an easier story to tell, I think, especially when a 3940 is 40 or 50 or whatever it would have been at the time. Mm-hmm. It's an easier story to tell in the value, and that's why they have increased in value. So it's a bit of a different thing, and I think telling the story of neo-vintage complicated watchmaking is a different market to try to explain.
Yeah, the last thing I'll say about Vacheron, and then we can move on, is I think that the challenge there is because, and Paul Boutros can fact check this for me later, but I believe most of the watches made before a certain year, I forget the year, are unique, like effectively unique. So whereas with Patek, you can say, oh, I've seen a 130 with a sector dial or this long signature or whatever. Like there's a market for that because there's been five similar sold in the past. With Vacheron, that doesn't really exist. There are similar watches, but never the same. And as you mentioned very, very correctly, they are way rarer than vintage Patek by like pretty wide margin. So like you have even less of them on the market.
But you want that like safety blanket.
You want to know what the market is. Yeah.
When you're spending that much money,
you want to know what the comps are. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, did I overspend on that? And I mean, I think even in our fantasy auction the other day, like I had that same feeling as without real money is like, oh, did I just get goaded into overspending on something? Well, okay. If you're talking about a watch that the asking price is $250,000 for a minute repeater or something like that, how do you know that you made the right decision?
Right.
And you don't.
Yeah.
There's a thin line between rarity and obscurity, someone once told me. And I think that lesson applies here.
Indeed.
Anything else that you guys saw at Phillips? I could talk about RM some more, but Ben, I want to kick it over to you first.
That was a great RM at Phillips too, actually. That was a really early one. That was an RM2. Let's see, what else did I see at Phillips? They had another nice Vacheron, the 4178. We'll just keep pulling on the Vacheron thread. They had that 1463 pink. Serpico Elino, which is, you know, that's a really neat spec of a 1463, and I think a little stronger case than the Tiffany one over at Sotheby's. I will say that the Tiffany Yellow Gold Breguet had a little bit more charm for me. It could just be it felt different than most of the other 1463s you see out there.
I think there was a little like wabi-sabi kind of like, whether it's the patina or the signature at the top or whatever it was, like that made that just an interesting 1463 at Sotheby's, but like it's a different buyer to me. Yeah. If you're buying the Serpico signed 1463, you're probably somebody that wants just a little bit more perfection out of the whole thing.
Yeah. Oh, actually, now that I think about it, there are two other watches at Phillips. Actually, a few other watches at Phillips.
They have some watches at Phillips.
They have some watches. Naoya Hida.
Yep.
They have over there.
Yeah.
I know you like that.
No, I think it's going to be one of my picks maybe for overlooked watch for the year. Just his work is really interesting, and I'm coming around in conversation to that, but I think it's a really great watch.
And impossible to get at retail effectively, like they're selling, like they do the raffle thing and you get like you know, there's like 10 of these watches allocated per year or something like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think also that's a relatively low estimate range, which is exciting. Yeah. It's meant to entice people potentially into buying it, but I'll be curious to see what the market decides is that opposite end of the spectrum. Space dwellers.
Yeah, that's where I was going.
Not everybody gets to see a space dweller every day. So I thought that was pretty fantastic to see.
Space dwellers neat. I own one, which is public information. They are,
like I said, not everybody gets to see one every day.
I happen to. they are so rare, so neat, so not understood. Like, we don't know, nobody knows the history of these things at all. Like, there were some dials at auction a while back. There were watches that we believe came, you know, made. This watch, the lore is that they were sold in Japan, you know, 1965, 1966 through 7. This watch was serviced in Japan, so lending some credence to that. But at the end of the day, we don't know. And on the paperwork, we don't frankly even know if that dial was in that watch when it was serviced. I'm not saying it wasn't, to be clear, but we don't know any of that. The service does not indicate what dial was in there. It does not say Space Dweller on the service.
But it also doesn't say Explorer on the service either.
Correct. These are really tricky watches. And again, like you're coming from somebody who bought one many years ago and continues to own it. I think these are incredibly special watches, kind of no matter the story. It's no different than, like, did the Paul Newman dial that's in so-and-so exist there when new? It kind of is irrelevant. You're paying for the dial. And a Space Dweller dial is the absolute coolest dial.
We do know that it sits in the serial range of sort of known Space Dwellers, if you will. So that at least is sort of correct, which is good to see. But yeah, it's probably the coolest 1016 dial I've ever seen. I love the honeycomb dials as well.
Yep.
I'm wearing a 1016 right now, but it's a boring old matte dial, and so I feel lame. That way even so more lame, so after seeing that Space Dweller.
Yeah.
But it's probably the most beautiful 1016 dial. I saw the albino one that Philips sold back in May.
Yep.
If this Space Dweller doesn't sell for, if it doesn't blow that out of the water, I'm gonna throw a fit because it's beautiful.
It should. And again, Jeff Hess and I talked about Explorers on our podcast together. And the Explorer, you know, is the choice of gentlemen such as yourself. I've owned a few. Like, they really thoughtful guys tend to buy these watches, but they never bring big money. You know, when I say big, I mean above 200,000. Look, all this money is big, but when you see standard stock and trade, you know, gilt, whatever, Explorer dial subs trading for 4 or 5, whatever. You're seeing mil subs in the 3, 4, 5 range. Like, a really, really special Explorer 1016 Space Dweller should be 250, 300 in my not so humble opinion.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, I would have gone even higher, but again, this is all imaginary money, but like 325, 350, just at this point for me, it's like that would be the one. I've come around to Explorers. I used to not be a 1016 guy, and now I think, you know, Rich Forden in the corner has cajoled me enough times and just beat it into me. But if you have the ability, why buy anything else? Like, get the one and be done.
Yep, agreed.
The most expensive sort of Explorer family watches I can think of are some basically pre-Explorers that sold last fall. Low 200s, I think. Rolex bought one of them. They had kind of Everest provenance, basically. So that's basically the highest we've seen. I don't think the Space Dweller will touch that, but just for reference, that's the most expensive sort of Explorer family watch I can think of. But before I let you guys go, this is my show now, I guess, Ben.
Great.
Before we leave it here, I wanted to ask you guys if you had a favorite watch that you saw today.
There's some nice 25-26s out there that I really liked. There was a watch that I was really looking forward to see at Sotheby's called a 3428, which is basically like a 2526 with the upgrade.
The next generation, yeah.
Exactly, yeah, from the early 60s instead of 50s. That was pulled from the online sale for some reason. We'll come back to that one. But that one was the one I was probably most excited to see. I'll be honest, the 1463J Breguet Tiffany, like that's my kind of thing. You know, that is, I'm a Tiffany guy. I'm from New York, as you know. A worn watch, like the super minty stuff, never really appeals to me. It's just kind of boring. Like, that feels like a collector that's just collecting to collect, not to own and wear. That was a really compelling thing.
John Player Special. You're right.
You win that one, actually.
No,
that,
I mean,
that watch is amazing. Yeah.
It's fantastic, and I am a big bracelet guy. Like, I spend time thinking about bracelets for watches that...
Like, how much time you spent thinking about bracelets?
I would say, like, I spent probably a good 30% of watch-related thinking time thinking about bracelets. Yeah. No, I mean, like, I think it's, you know, or at least if I'm going to pick a watch to wear, generally, across the board, I'll want it a bracelet or a beads of rice or something like that. I'll take that all day, every day of the week, 365 days of the year. I'll take
that watch. And yet, you chose the watch without a bracelet.
No, and I know. That's what I'm saying. So yeah. that just goes to show how great that watch is. Now, if I wanted to wreck the back of the lugs, I could find a bracelet and put it on, but yeah.
Yeah. Tony?
As established, I'm a bit of an everyman, so all I need is that simple Vacheron 4072. As I'll remind you, the estimate was 15 to 30. You guys chose watches well into the six figures.
Okay, okay. But can I put like a $200,000 floor or something like that? Because I wanna see if you were just going all out.
No. It's my favorite watch of the entire sale weekend. You know, as a Chicagoan, I'm not much of a Tiffany guy either. The signature just doesn't do that much for me. The JPS is a cool watch that was in beautiful condition, but if I can get something like the 4072 for that cheap, why not, baby?
Are you going to bid on that watch?
No.
We picked our favorites effectively. So which watch do you think is kind of the most, the greatest bellwether for the entire watch market right now? Is it the JPS? Is it the Pink 1518? Are those a little bit too big dog to kind of represent the market at large? Is it, you know, Phillips has a really nice mint 6263 big red, which to me, I think described as the bellwether of the vintage market. Is it that?
That would have been my pick, but now I look like I'm just copying what you're saying. Okay. So I don't know.
When I'm right, Mark.
I think, you know, this might be not necessarily a bellwether of the highest end of the vintage market, because I have a sense that like things like 1518 or 1463 are going to stick relatively in a range that they're known for. But I would say maybe, actually we didn't talk about it, at Cartier Benoit that was at Sotheby's that had provenance from Charlie Chaplin giving it to his wife. Yeah. Like, okay, how much are people willing to spend on, you know, sort of a mid low estimate watch, below $30,000 estimate. Yeah. And pay for the provenance, like how are people going to feel? Like, yes, it's not representative of every single Benoit, but it gives me a sense of like, okay, are people going to pay up for this kind of thing?
Yeah, what do people care about?
Or are they not?
Yeah.
I've got a good one for you, I think. There's a Tropical Dial 5512 Submariner at Sotheby's. It's actually from the same collector that has that 1463 that you keep talking about, which I think kind of shows the sort of level of this Submariner. Some guy that's buying Breguet Tiffany signed Patek's would be interested in this sub. It's on a Jubilee bracelet, it's a really nice watch. The case is nice and the dial is obviously beautiful. You know, again, Hess was really excited about it, and he's sort of the Submariner guru. So if he's excited about it, I think it'll be interesting to see how a good Rolex Submariner like that does on to see what it says about the market. I think the estimate is 50 to 100, I should say.
Yeah.
So we'll see, but I think that's a good one.
It is. That, I mean, let's be clear. That's a spicy estimate for a Submariner.
Totally.
Yeah, and I also think that there was the 5513 that they had at Sotheby's as well, that like Comex dial. Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's a little extra sauce there. Will people continue paying up for that? Do people want extra provenance with how it was used, how it was not used? I mean, that's, again, like if you're taking a watch plus that is still not a 1518 or something, but like looking for watches with a little bit extra, that might be an interesting one to watch as well.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is the, I think that for me, it probably is the 6263 Big Red because it's very easy to understand. It's a full set. It's a good watch. But I think weirdly, the things that are probably most telling, you know, at Phillips in particular, you usually get this kind of like auction bump where like you can go to Chrono 24 and buy the same watch for a little bit less. A 15202, a 5711, like the most basic watches ever, like that I think will be a really good indicator of where things are. Is there still hype around the market where you feel like you can't get a 15202 or now a 16202 at auction or at retail, then maybe it'll do well. I don't know. So we have Sotheby's coming up tomorrow, which would be Thursday, December 7th, and then Phillips is over the weekend, Saturday, Sunday. These are public auctions. I encourage you guys to go check them out. Go check out the previews. It's one of the best ways to learn about watches. And we will see you next week with our good friend, Mr. John J. Reardon, talking about vintage Patek Philippe.